National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the listeners of WKNO in Memphis and by the Hyde Family Foundation, investing in enlightened leadership, transforming the future of children and community.
I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. The 30-second spot is a familiar part of our lives. It pays for most of our television programming and our commercial radio. It puts the jingles in our head that stick with us forever. But TiVo, DVR, and plenty of choices could make the 30-second spot obsolete. So what comes next? Joseph Jaffe tells us in his new book, Life After the 30-Second Spot, and he is our guest today on Smart City. And we'll continue our discussion on marketing with Barbara Kahn, marketing professor at the Wharton School. She studies consumer choice and brand loyalty, and we'll talk to her about those topics and more today on Smart City. But first, the news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Joseph Jaffe is author of Life After the 30-Second Spot. He is also president and founder of Jaffe LLC, a new marketing consulting practice. Prior to consulting, Joseph was director of interactive media at TBWA, Chiat Day, and OMD USA, where he worked on clients including Kmart, Absolut Vodka, Embassy Suites, and Samsonite. He is a senior fellow at the Center for the Digital Future at USC Annenberg School. Joseph, do you watch 30-second spots?
To be honest with you, since I got a DVR, since I got TiVo, I basically don't watch any television commercials anymore. And I'm not alone. In fact, one out of every five TiVo consumers claim to skip 100% of all commercials.
Do you listen to radio ads?
I don't. I change the channel. You know, and if I go from one channel to another channel to another channel, and they're all simultaneously broadcasting ads at the same time, it irritates me to the point that I put my CD on or even switch the radio off.
Do you read newspaper ads?
I go to the web for all my newspaper articles and consumption.
Does your browser allow pop-ups?
It does allow pop-ups, I believe. The question is, do I watch or do I consume online ads? To a degree, I do, but at the same time, I wouldn't say that online advertising is any better or worse off than the rest of advertising.
So is it fair to assume that old media are no longer working when it comes to advertising?
What's interesting is, and the reason why I kind of I skirted the online example a little bit more carefully, is the fact that I think that old, and you just hit it, I think, the nail on the head, old marketing or old media as a concept can in fact spread and cover the web. I think it's when new marketing is applied in an innovative way, not just to the web, but even to television, radio, and print, that's when you start seeing consumers reacting slightly differently. And you know, that's not esoteric. What I'm referring to, for example, is podcasting. Podcasting can very easily and may very well breathe new life into radio.
Tell me what percentage of advertising dollars are still being spent on what I would call old you just called old marketing, and I'll call old media.
It's not about percentages. Let me answer that in a different way. About 100 years ago, give or take a few years, a retailing pioneer by the name of John Wanamaker came out with the following statement. He said, half of my advertising is wasted. The only problem is I don't know which half.
That's a great line, isn't it?
And here's the scary truth, is that today, in 2005, many marketers and many media professionals still use that line. And first of all, it's unacceptable. Second of all, not only do we know which percentage of those dollars is wasted, they may very well be more than 50%. So I think the issue is not about the end or the death of advertising. I think it's the need to weed out bad advertising, badly targeted advertising, really advertising that serves no purpose, that isn't relevant, that isn't utilitarian, that isn't entertaining, that isn't engaging at all. Because it's that advertising that I think is almost, I would say, irrevocably poisoning the waters of the good advertising.
But people create advertising, Joseph, and so how do you weed out all of those things you'd like to weed out?
Well, I think that part of the solution lies, and I cover this in the book, in something I call advertising on demand, AOD. It's inviting consumers to actually not just give permission, not just opt in to advertising, but I think actually to self-select their advertising off the bat. I'll give you an example to bring this, you know, a little bit more down to earth. Think about watching television and think about, you know, being in the market to buy a new car. What if you could actually, through the web or through a remote control, punch in that you were actually in the market to buy a car? And through, you know, the ability to target you or to send that information out without personally identifying you, in other words, respecting your privacy and keeping your identity anonymous, what if now a disproportionate amount of advertising was focused on automotive? And then, of course, the kicker would be once you purchase that car, that you could actually switch that off and say, you know what, I don't want to find out about new car offers because the worst thing I want to do is get that cognitive dissonance that I actually made a mistake or that I got ripped off or maybe there was a better deal or a better model out there. So I think that's one way that we can actually use technology to almost enhance or evolve the existing business model. And by the way, you know, if it isn't obvious already, the 30-second spot may continue to survive under those conditions.
Let me give you another example and let you respond to this. Let's take a product like Clorox disinfecting wipes. It's a good product. It's very convenient. But is anyone ever going to say, I'm opting in. I do want to see that spot about how to clean my bathroom better. I don't think so.
Well, you know, it's very interesting because you're zoning in on the you know, on the huge consumer packaged goods industry, and you have Procter & Gamble, which is not one of the two largest advertisers in this country. And by the way, P&G have recently slashed their television ad spending. So that's one savvy marketer that's jumped on the bandwagon. But just getting back to CPG for a second, the category is hallmarked by low involvement, highly frequently purchased items in an otherwise mature market. In other words, we don't really care and put too much thought and consideration into disinfectant, into wipes, and so on and so forth. So how do you achieve the ultimate, which is high involvement, in a low involvement category? Well, I'll give you two examples. One of the best examples out there came from M&M's. They came out with their global color vote. So in other words, involving all their consumers to actually say, you know what, the next color that comes out, you will have the ultimate say. You will be able to literally globally, democratically register your vote. And so they created this experience, and people could go to a website to vote for the color that they wanted to be the next M&M flavor or color in this particular case. And that was one way of actually achieving high involvement. Another example, very recent, is for Method. In fact, a website was created for Method, and it won the Grand Prix at Cannes in the cyber category. The whole idea of cleanliness and cleansing oneself and cleansing one's sins became the idea for almost a website devoted to confessionals. So you can go to this website and you can actually put in your own confession so that you could essentially cleanse yourself. Or if you didn't want to admit to perhaps a sin, you could view other people's confessions. Again, a way of bringing people together, bringing a community together and getting them excited about, in this case, an attribute that was very, very closely aligned with Method. So it is possible. It's certainly not the norm across the board, but it is possible by embracing a new marketing philosophy.
And those are two wonderful examples. On the other hand, we're all pushed for time, so I can't afford to be involved at that level with all the products that I consume and have to make decisions about. So if everyone jumps to trying to push us into high involvement, I mean, won't there be pushback?
Let that be the worst of our worries and the worst of our fears, because right now those examples are few and far between. They really are the exceptions to the rule as opposed to the norm. What's happening, unfortunately, is that a lot of dollars and a lot of focus and concentration right now is in product placement. And that concerns me greatly. What's happening is with the failing of the 30-second spot, what most marketers are doing is they're still reaching for the security blanket of television, you know, to be close to television. And they're going in one of three places. One is to the internet. Through broadband internet access, they're able to put their television commercials online, probably a short-term solution to a longer-term problem. The other thing they're doing is they're starting to experiment with video on demand because, again, it's still television and a television derivational product. The third thing they're doing is product placement. So they're starting to, as I call it, infest content with their commercial messaging. And the problem is that, you know, consumers, I think, are very soon going to essentially revolt against that. Right now, we're on target for 4 times the amount of product placement in the top 10 shows on television in 2005 compared to 2004. And I think the quintessential example right now is if you think about reality television, whether it's Survivor, whether it's American Idol, or most notably The Apprentice. Right now, the entire episode of The Apprentice is essentially a paid ad. So I think what's happening right now is your scenario is probably a lot longer off than what's actually happening right now with product placement, et cetera.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Joseph Jaffe. He's author of the provocative new book, Life After the 30-Second Spot. Okay, Joseph, who's going to pay for television if no one is watching these commercials and we're all TiVoing across them and we're all going to push back on product placement?
That's a rhetorical question if I ever heard one, because, of course, the answer is you and I. And it's a damn good question as well. You know, I think the thing is that if commercials go away in entirety, what obviously happens is that content becomes not just expensive, but most likely too expensive for the average American consumer. It may work for HBO, but it's really not going to be able to work for, you know, across the board. And even if it did, it's probably only going to be 3 to 5 channels, and there are going to be about 95 other channels that essentially get frozen out. But it's really more than that. You know, to justify the existence of advertising just because it subsidizes content is obviously not good enough. You used an example earlier of Clorox. I'll give you another example. Tide has just come out with some kind of a chapstick-type product. So, you know, I travel a lot, and, you know, should I spill wine or something like that on my suit, I would definitely benefit from having this Tide product to be able to eradicate any stains or at least kind of minimize them before they got worse. But if there was no advertising, I'd probably never find out about that product and its benefits. So there will always, I think, be a role for advertising. You know, the problem is, am I as a consumer going to sit through 25 commercials so that I can eventually be surprised by something like this type of product? But back to your question for a second, who's going to pay? Well, the answer is you and I. And I don't think that that ultimately would be a long-term viable solution. But it certainly still does not give us license to sit back and point a finger at the consumer and say, you better watch these bad ads, otherwise content's going to become expensive. You know, the onus is still on us as marketers, as media professionals, to figure out how to improve and fix this model and evolve it.
In your book, you've come up with 10 alternatives to the 30-second spot, and you've been hinting at some of them. Why don't you talk about those alternatives?
Well, you know, some are quite obvious, like I spoke about the internet, interactive. The others are derivations thereof, for example, search. The concept of being able to pull advertising or pull content or pull information by just going straight to a search engine and typing in whatever you're looking for is obviously, you know, a huge benefit for consumers. And there are ways of using, well, first of all, search marketing in general is just a huge way for marketers to meet their consumers halfway. But then there are some more, I call them esoteric, but they're not really that esoteric. And I'll give you some examples. There is what I call consumer-generated content, which to me is a very, very exciting and untapped opportunity. Here's an example. A school teacher by the name of George Masters came out with his own iPod ad. He really loved the brand, and as a celebration or an expression of his love and passion for the brand, he created a 60-second commercial, which he put on his website. A few blogs picked it up, and before he knew it, over 100,000 people had viewed his ad. American Airlines, they have this whole campaign called We Know Why You Fly. And what they actually did is they captured these home movies from actual consumers, you know, demonstrating the joys of uniting, for example, grandparents with their grandkids. And they used that content to be the next wave of advertising coming out from American Airlines. It's what I call reality advertising, you know, which is so much better than reality TV. And so that's another example. A couple of other approaches that I talk about experiential marketing. Experiential marketing is really nothing new, and it really has nothing to do with technology, but it is one of the most effective ways of being able to take a brand and insert context into that brand. The problem with branding right now is that brands have become ends unto themselves, and they really need to be enablers. They need to be means to an end. So I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. Jeep. Jeep is a fantastic brand that has always been a very aspirational brand. You've never seen a Jeep ad that doesn't show that Jeep off-road. It's always about being able to kind of take on the rugged adventures of life and so on and so forth, quite literally. Most consumers are never going to take that Jeep off-road. So what Jeep did is they really brought the road to their consumer, and they created something called Camp Jeep. And through Camp Jeep, customers, you know, prospects, people looking to buy a Jeep could actually go into these giant indoor arenas, get behind the wheel of a Jeep, and really take this car off-road, so to speak, by going over this man-made, almost obstacle course. It was a way of being able to bring the experience or add experience to the existing proposition. And if you think about it, the advertising up until that point was nothing more than an empty promise. Camp Jeep was the opportunity to come good on that promise.
I want to come back to the American Airlines example you gave. When it comes to actually making a choice about which airline you fly, perhaps the larger question is the advertising really relevant, even though it's reality advertising, it's a different technique, it's consumer-generated content, it's all those things you talk about, but in the end, is it really relevant?
You ask a fantastic question, and, you know, I'm going to answer it two ways. The first is to say that, you know, ultimately, the car we drive, the car you drive, the car I drive, the brand of beer that I might drink, the line of clothing that you might choose to purchase from, or clothing store, whether it's, you know, let's say Gap or Banana Republic, we don't quite know why we make the decisions that we make. They're not always rational decisions. The best example has to be Starbucks. We continue, you know, to walk into our local Starbucks and we pay $4 for a latte, but none of us feel like we're being ripped off at all because we're getting part of that Starbucks experience. So the fact is, there always will be emotional drivers and drivers that we can't quite reduce to very simple, linear, rational motivators. Now, that's the one part. The other part is that there will always be a way for advertising to essentially establish a competitive advantage. This doesn't necessarily go down to a very simple economic or even rational motivator, but the fact is, you know, Delta is a good example. Let's switch gears for a second. Delta were the first airline to really not just come out with that online check-in concept and kiosk check-in, but they were the first to really put their marketing and advertising dollars behind it. So they were able to use that new product benefit, if you will, or service benefit, as a very real competitive differentiator and use it to their advantage. And I think really what's happening now, I'm going on a slight tangent, but I think it's relevant, is that we're living in a world now where, because of the internet, information is free and information is transparent, and really all products are becoming somewhat commoditized. One is not necessarily cheaper or more expensive than the other because we can use the web to compare prices so easily. So what differentiates one brand from another, one product from another, or one service from another? It could ironically end up being advertising, you know, and again, those intangible reasons that make you feel good about yourself, that make you feel confident about your choice, and really show how that choice and that brand or that product or that service actually can fit into your life and become part of a much more complex and dynamic tapestry.
One of the ways in which companies are trying to reach consumers today is sponsoring the public realm, and it could be messages in schools, it could be public plazas, of course sponsorship of special events, but I'm wondering if you think resentment is going to develop about the intrusion of product messages into new places.
I think that, you know, certainly to brand the cafeteria or to, you know, or to go too deep into our lives, for example, schools, and start owning elements of that result in some kind of backlash of some sort. But I actually think that there is something bigger that is happening right now. And that bigger thing is for brands to become enablers. There is a huge cause marketing opportunity, I believe. And I think that brands really can play a role and make a difference in our lives. In the book, I talk about an example, Wiring America. I think right now, a brand to get behind that initiative, to make sure that there is internet access in every single home, I think that is a cause that a brand should embrace, and it's a cause that I think consumers would embrace as well. GE has just come out with a massive eco-friendly campaign right now. So I think that brands can actually really dovetail on the fact that, you know what, just invading our attention spans and insulting our intelligence through a monotonous plethora of 30-second spots, that's not going to do it. But what if a brand can actually make a difference? What if a brand can actually play a part in our lives? Going back to your question for a second, again, there is intrusion that can take place in the form of 30-second spots. And they also can be that experiential intrusion in terms of actually invading our personal space and our personal lives. Clearly, that's not something that I would advocate.
As you finished your book, and of course you've reflected on it, was there a question for you that you found intriguing about life after the 30-second spot that you just couldn't get to in your book?
That's a very interesting question. There are so many questions that or topics that I want to continue delving into. I've actually done something quite interesting, I think, which is I created and launched my blog about 3 months before the book came out. It's called Jaffe Juice, and the URL is www.jaffejuice.com, J-A-F-F-E-J-U-I-C-E. You know, at first I created the blog, and I used the blog to start documenting any stories that came out that occurred after the book went to print. But what the blog has actually ended up doing is keeping the book alive. So anything that happens even after that book ultimately went to print and came out and was released in the stores continues to live on the blog. And so in a way I've kept the book itself alive. The book, which is very much an old marketing idea, very, you know, if you think about it, of a linear, once-off static execution, but I've been able to keep it alive dynamically through a daily blog that gets updated. But to go back to your question, is there one unanswered question in a sense? Somebody asked me this question last week. They said to me, what is the possibility of a world without advertising? And it was exactly similar to the question you asked me, which is, you know, who pays for the content? And I gave them the same answer I gave you, and then I felt like a cop-out. I felt like, you know, I had avoided a very real possibility that right now there could actually be a world without advertising, and the issue is that there already is a world without advertising. We started this interview off with you asking me, do I watch ads, do I listen to ads, do I read ads? The answer is no. And I think the biggest fear right now for marketers is not to be skipped or fast-forwarded or to have the channel changed. It's actually just to be forgotten. It's to be ignored. It's for any messaging, good, bad, or ugly, just to become white noise. And so one of the things I'm starting to spend a lot of time on now is thinking about that world without advertising and really trying to take this message out to marketers to say the stakes are so high right now. If we don't do something right now, we may not get another chance.
The book is Life After the 30-Second Spot. Energize your brand with a bold mix of alternatives to traditional advertising. It's an Adweek book from Wiley Publishers. Joseph Jaffe, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thanks so much for having me.
After a short break, we'll return to talk to Otis White about high-tech parking meters. And in the second half of our show, we'll talk with Wharton Professor Barbara Kahn about Chubby Hubby and trailer trash, ambiguous flavor and color names, and why they sell. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Parking meters are pretty mundane piece of urban furniture, but I've seen a couple of interesting meters lately in cities. They actually look pretty darn good, and they're not stopping there. There are innovations in the parking meter's future.
Yeah, who could have imagined this, Carol, that there is a technology revolution taking place in parking meters of all things. The parking meters are getting pretty sneaky, actually. The electronics is allowing them to do things most people really don't want to know about. For instance, you and I have both had that wonderful, happy feeling of pulling into a parking space which actually still had time on the meter.
Ah, yes.
Well, they've fixed them now in some places where when the car leaves the parking space, it automatically resets to zero. They also have parking meters that will summons, you know, the meter reader types whenever it goes to zero. They actually will show up as a red spot on the maps that these parking agents carry on handheld devices. But that's nothing. The most amazing piece of technology has to do with the practice of chalking, and everybody knows what I'm talking about. It's the agent comes by on a little sort of motor scooter type thing and has a pole with a piece of chalk on the end, and they chalk your tires. And then they come back in 2 hours, and if there's a chalk tire there, they know that person deserves a ticket. Well, what they've come up with now is an electronic camera that photographs the license plates and records exactly the time that they were photographed. They actually register instantaneously that automobile with a global positioning satellite. I'm not making this up, which keeps photographing your car. And if your car is still there in 2 hours, it's going to, again, summon that police officer, and they're going to come around and give you a ticket. The camera has a couple of bonuses. One of the things is it instantly identifies license plates belonging to scofflaws. Those are people who never paid their parking tickets. And the other thing it does is it immediately notifies you when there's a stolen car there. So in Sacramento, where they're pioneering this camera thing, they've actually located 11 stolen cars in 3 months' time, which is pretty amazing.
It is amazing. I think transit chiefs around the country are going to rejoice.
And most parkers are going to weep when this new system goes into effect.
Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Okay, Carol.
You're listening to Smart City. Barbara Kahn is the Dorothy Silberberg Professor of Marketing at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania and Vice Dean and Director of the Undergraduate Program at Wharton. She co-authored the book Grocery Revolution, The Focus on the Consumer, and has conducted professional seminars for corporations and trade associations throughout the world. Her research interests include consumer choice, brand loyalty, customization, and decisions made under uncertainty and ambiguity. Barbara, you recently studied the effect color and flavor names have on what we buy. Now, what am I supposed to think about a color named gunpowder? What happened to gray and black?
Well, that's actually exactly what we were interested in. When you have a descriptor of a color or a flavor name that doesn't add any information, why are marketers doing that? It's obviously, if you look in the marketplace, it's obviously somewhat successful. And generally what marketers will do is throw something out on the marketplace, and if there's a positive response to it, they'll continue doing it. So that we see that it's happening in a lot of different categories. It makes it clear that this must be a successful strategy. But what we were interested in is why. Why is that happening? So we ran a study to try to determine that.
So this is happening not only in color names, it's happening with flavor names. Chubby Hubby ice cream, which I thought was so funny. How does a customer know what Chubby Hubby tastes like? What did you find in your research that suggested why marketers are in fact using these sorts of nondescriptive names?
Okay, so what we found was that these atypical names are basically causing consumers to think about it a little. We call it elaboration, or to process this information just a little bit to try to figure out maybe why it was called that or come up with some reason that they think makes some sense. And it's just that tiny bit of more thought, of more elaboration, that seems to add a positive dimension to the product. So really all we think that's happening is that people are just noticing it, they're thinking about it, why did they do this, and that extra little bit of elaboration or thinking is making them more favorably disposed towards the products or flavors.
A marketer would not want me to finish the thought or elaborate on the thought and come up with a negative reason. So is there's an assumption that I'm going to fill in with a positive reason?
That's the other thing that we thought. And actually, what you're suggesting is what we'd call a boundary condition to this effect. If people were elaborating and it came up with some kind of negative information, that obviously would not be very good. But I don't think people think about this too much. And I think they go in thinking, well, this is advertising, this is marketing. The marketer must have some positive reason. So they tend to think about what the positive reason would be. We liken this to the kinds of assumptions people make in conversation. So many times when you're talking with someone, the actual literal thing that they say doesn't make sense, but you kind of fill in the blanks so that it does make sense. There's a famous example, like if I ask somebody where Dave is, and that person responds, there's a yellow VW outside of Susan's house. Now, that's not really a direct answer to what I asked, but what I assume then is that, well, Dave must have a yellow VW, and that's parked outside of Susan's house, so therefore Dave must be at Susan's house. So I fill in all of those blanks because I make the assumption that the person who's talking to me is trying to give me information. So we think that's the same thing that happens in this situation. The consumer sees this name. It doesn't really make sense, but they make the attribution that the marketer's trying to give you some positive information. So they fill in that positive blank in some sense, and that makes them more favorably disposed towards the product.
I'm just curious if you know whether there's a difference between men and women being able to fill in the blanks.
We didn't find any gender effects in this study. And even if we did, I wouldn't be sure that it would necessarily be true in the marketplace, because occasionally when I run studies in my laboratory, I do find differences between women and men, and sometimes it's just that women seem to pay more attention to the stimuli in the laboratory. And I'm not sure that would generalize to the marketplace or not.
Do ambiguous names sell better in every category?
Well, again, I think that would be a boundary condition. We looked at fun product categories. So we looked at candies and juices and sweaters and things that were in color, you know, colors of sweaters and things like that. So it was all the kinds of things where it would be fun to think of variety or to think of these different names. I would imagine that ambiguity in categories that bear some risk would be negative. So something that was ambiguous maybe in a pharmaceutical product or something like that would make you more nervous, that you wouldn't necessarily assume it was a good thing.
Hmm. How did you find out the reaction consumers have to these ambiguous names?
Well, we ran some controlled studies, and that's one of the things we were trying to do in the lab. So in the lab, we had some artificial stimuli, and in some sense you can say that's a criticism of the study because it doesn't have what we call external validity. It's not something that was actually done in the marketplace. But the advantage of doing it in the lab is that I can control everything else and just study this particular effect. So I can control for price and brand name and all these other things, which we think actually are very big effects on consumer choice, and just look at these kinds of effects. The first thing we wanted to determine was that it was a cognitive response rather than an emotional response or some other kind of visceral or gut reaction. And so what we did is we had a controlled experiment where in one situation we had these ambiguous names and another situation we had more typical names. And we crossed that with whether or not we distracted the participants while they were choosing products. And what we found is when we distracted them, although they saw the names of the brand names or these color names that were ambiguous versus regular, there was no effect. But when we didn't distract them and they had time to think about it a little, that's when we had the effect. So that study pointed out to us that it was a cognitive response, an elaboration response, rather than any other kind of response.
Mm-hmm. And you used jelly beans?
One of our categories, we used jelly beans, and we did... So we used ambiguous flavors. So in that case, we had the flavors were like Moody Blue or Florida Red versus Blueberry Blue and Cherry Red. And what we found was with these ambiguous flavor names, which were not giving you any information about what was going on with the jelly beans, what the jelly beans would taste like, when people were not distracted, they tended to choose more jelly beans or be more satisfied with the jelly beans in the ambiguous condition than in the condition where the color names were more descriptive. And one other thing we found, which we didn't mention before, is we also found that if the name was atypical but did give him some information, that could also be useful. Like, for example, Coke Red or Freckle Brown might be descriptors that you don't really think about, but they actually give you some information, but they're new. They're novel. And there is an effect of this novelty. If people like to, and what we found was the process there was that people like to disentangle the puzzle. Like, why did I call it Freckle Brown? Or why is this name here? And again, it's that little bit of extra elaboration that makes the product more positive. So the overall conclusions for marketers would be, you know, these unusual names get customers' attention, and if they think about it, and as long as the thinking that they do is on the positive side, on the margin, that'll give a little bit of a boost to your product. The caveat is, if it bleeds over into some kind of negative thinking, then it won't work. And the other caveat is, it only works for a certain amount of time as long as it's novel. As soon as you get used to it, I don't think it has that effect anymore.
Well, we're flooded with product choices today, and I recently purchased a television. I don't remember a more complicated decision. It was so frustrating. It almost paralyzed me. How do consumers wade through all the information available today and make decisions?
Yeah, well, as the decision gets more complex, what we find is people frequently go through staged decision-making. And so at the first stage, what they do is they use a lot of what we call a conjunctive rule or a minimum threshold rule. And although it doesn't necessarily result in the most normative or the most optimal decision, what people will do is say, I'll cancel out all the options that don't meet this minimum standard. So they'll try to reduce the set of this huge complex set to a smaller, more manageable set. And within that smaller, more manageable set, they'll consider lots of different attributes and go through the more difficult process of making trade-offs.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Barbara Kahn. She's the Dorothy Silberberg Professor of Marketing at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. I want to switch subjects a minute and talk about a paper you wrote a few years ago on corporate sponsorships of philanthropic activities and their impact on the perception of the sponsor's brand. Many businesses see sponsorships as an alternative way to reach consumers as traditional media opportunities are declining. Do sponsorships in fact work to boost the brand?
Well, one of the things that we found was it depends on the attributions that the consumers are making as to why the sponsor is doing it and whether or not the brand is congruent with the cause. So if the consumer thinks that the sponsor is doing it for a good reason and it makes sense for this particular brand to sponsor this particular cause, then it tends to be a positive thing for the brand. But there's something called this persuasion knowledge model, which says if the consumer can see through what tactics you're using to try to persuade them, then they are not fooled by that persuasion tactic as easily or as much. It doesn't work on them. And so if the consumer reads these kinds of sponsorships as in the brand's best interest rather than in the interest of the cause, it may not be as helpful.
Can you give me an example of what you would say would be a good brand match with a cause?
Well, for example, take breast cancer. So if there's a product category that's catering to women, you know, like the sports shoes that for women, Ryko, something like that, that they didn't do breast cancer, but something like that that's a product that's related to the people who get this disease, then that would be a match that would make sense. If it was a product that was completely independent, it may have no effect, but it's unlikely to necessarily increase the value of the brand.
What is your reaction to alternative media and the opportunities they offer marketers, like sponsorships?
Oh, I think that sponsorships are a very important way to build brand equity, because I think one of the biggest assets that a firm has is its brand. And what you need to do is constantly keep that brand relevant and keep that brand differentiated. And what you want to do is generate positive consumer interest in your brand name, a positive reaction to that brand name. And so sponsoring events or causes or charities or things like that that are positive can just keep that brand name fresh and relevant to the appropriate consumer base. But you do want to be strategic from a brand point of view. There's other reasons like there's altruistic reasons, which I would certainly support, and social responsibility reasons and things like that, which obviously make a lot of sense. But when you're just talking about the value of the brand name, you want to be a little bit strategic in what kinds of sponsorships you go after.
You lead a lot of corporate marketing seminars. Tell me, what are the most vexing marketing questions for the corporate leaders you meet with?
Well, a lot of the big issues nowadays is how to, you know, our growth strategies, and a lot of people are looking at how to, different ways to grow. And one way to grow is through brand. So if you have a really powerful brand name, you want to try to use that brand name to leverage growth. So you might think of brand extensions. What other product categories can I put my brand name on that will bring me in increased profitability? So that's one way to think of growth, through leveraging a very strong, powerful brand name. Another way to think about growth is through leveraging a strong relationship with a customer. So if you're really meeting the needs of a customer segment very well, you might want to think about other ways you can meet that customer segment's needs, or try to keep those customers loyal over time. And so in that sense, what you're trying to do is leverage or build on your relationship with your customer. And those are two different ways to think about growth. Which is in addition to the more traditional ways of thinking about growth, like developing new products or things like that. Mm-hmm. But a lot of what marketers are looking at now are customer strategies or brand strategies.
You teach marketing students, of course, at the Wharton School. Tell me the most important lessons that you're teaching your students today.
Well, when I talk about marketing, a lot of it's in the nuance and in the implementation, but really there's just two main points to marketing, main principles. And the first principle is the principle of customer value. And it's hard sometimes to remember this, but what a good marketer would do is try to create value for the customer. So you don't want to sell the customer something they don't want, or push something on the customer. What you're trying to do is create a product or service that meets customer needs. So that's the first simple principle, the principle of customer value. And the second principle is do it better than the competition. So meet customer needs better than the competition. That's the principle of differential advantage. And if you boil marketing down, it's really down to those two simple principles, and it can get very complicated in the implementation, and there's a lot of detail that you can work around it. But those are the two basic ideas.
Is there anything that you emphasize to your students today that you didn't, say, 5 years ago?
Even 5 years ago, this focus on customer, it's deceptively simple. It's actually quite difficult to implement. 5 years ago, approximately, we really taught marketing about the product, and it was very product-centered. So you develop a product and try to think about ways to market that product so the customer would want that product. That's kind of start with what you're good at inside and then push it out. What we talk about marketing nowadays is outside in. Start with what the customer wants and create products and services to meet the customer need. It's quite a different focus, and it requires really different skills.
And how are the skills different?
You have to become an expert at what the customer wants rather than an expert at what you do well. And so some people are very good at thinking about what they want or what they're good at, or thinking about technology or product-related factors, but they're less good about listening to the customer, understanding what they want, figuring out how the customer's using the product. There really are very different skills. One's a listening skill in some sense, and the other's a product development, technology kind of skill.
Do you think the techniques that are being used today to listen to customers, particularly the techniques grounded in anthropology, going out and observing what customers do rather than listen to what customers say they do, do you think that is valuable? Is that a topic of discussion at the Wharton School with your marketing students?
Yeah, I don't personally do that research, but I respect that research a lot, this idea of like living with the customers or becoming participant observers and understanding the whole culture that goes around the product and the way they use it, or the event, or the culture that develops around a brand. For example, there's a lot of research on brand communities, like the whole community around the Apple brand or around the Harley-Davidson brand. The idea that it's more than just a brand name, it's actually a culture, it's a community. There's a lot of things that go with that brand. And a lot of that you have to get from living with the customer and seeing how they're using the product. I think that's very interesting kind of information to learn.
It's interesting when you talk about the community around the brand, you use the same examples that everyone else uses, which suggests to me that there really aren't many brands around which a community has developed.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's like the pinnacle of a great, strong brand. It's when the customer becomes an advocate for the brand. So when the customer starts being the best salesperson, they identify themselves as an Ann Taylor customer. You know, sometimes you see it with fashion design and stuff, like some of the celebrities are Armani celebrities, you know, mm-hmm. that kind of mm-hmm. notion. That is the idea. It's resonance. You so identify with the brand that it becomes your own identity.
In marketing today, have you seen companies make that switch from being product-centered to being customer-centered? Which companies have done it well?
Any industry, as it gets more and more competitive, is moving from that inside out to that outside in perspective. So you're seeing it really across all industries. It happened earliest probably in financial services because that was very, very competitive. And then what they started moving from was a transaction-based, product-oriented culture to a customer relationship culture. So there's a lot of the kinds of new thinking in customer relationship management or CRM or those kinds of issues developed in financial services and is being used in other as models for other industries.
What do you think is key to being able to do that well, to be customer-centered?
First of all, you have to have the culture. You have to have the philosophy, which is not a small thing, because when you're inside out, you're depending on your own expertise for generating new ideas and for growth strategies. When you're outside in, you're putting the future of the firm on what the customer wants, you know, and that customer may be a little crazy. So it's really kind of a very big culture shift. So if you can move your culture from that's the first step. The second thing is you have to have the right kind of people who can hear, who collect the information, who can hear what the customer has to say. And a lot of this is data-oriented. So it's not about just anecdotes. It's about going out, conducting the appropriate market research, bringing in that data, and then analyzing that data to detect what it is that customers want. The whole thing is an exchange. Marketing is about the exchange, right? So the firm puts something into the exchange and the customer takes it out. And there's always going to be those two sides to it.
Barbara, I want to thank you for being our guest on Smart City.
Oh, sure. Thank you.
Barbara Kahn is the Dorothy Silberberg Professor of Marketing at the Wharton School. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. City View's commentator Walker Smith says an increase in consumer choices and control may mean trouble for old marketers, but it can have a positive effect on commerce. Just look at eBay.
In the city of Greenville, South Carolina, free umbrellas are available to people who park in the public lots. On rainy days, if someone needs an umbrella, he or she is welcome to take one from the yellow bin sitting near the entrances. There is another bin at the exit gates for people to return the umbrellas they have borrowed. Nobody keeps tabs on the umbrellas. There is no bureaucracy for checkout and check-in. This is a courtesy system that operates on an assumed honor code. And it is a refreshing affirmation of a belief in people's basic honesty and integrity. This belief isn't some mawkish sentimentality with which the town leaders of Greenville are fooling themselves. This is also the core belief at the heart of eBay, one of the largest, most successful businesses in the world. The apocryphal story of eBay's beginnings is well known. Peter Omidyar, a French-Iranian American who immigrated to the United States at age 6, spent Labor Day weekend 1995 developing an auction website that his fiancée Pam could use to buy and sell the Pez dispensers she collected. He first called it AuctionWeb, and announced it to other early internet users on a couple of online bulletin boards. The genius of eBay is that it allows its customers to control everything. From the start, the core concept has been to let users manage themselves and their online auctions and relationships. In the early years, when disputes arose between buyers and sellers, Omidyar encouraged people to work things out on their own. He constantly reminded disputants that other people are basically good and that most disagreements probably arise through misunderstandings. On eBay, users rate one another. Users find community and build relationships. Buyers and sellers negotiate all the prices. Users control their own inventory and shipping. Customers buy and sell directly from one another. eBay simply provides the platform. eBay operates without a central authority to control everything. And this works because eBay knows, like the city of Greenville, South Carolina, that people are basically good. This is not a popular idea these days. On both sides of the political spectrum, we are constantly assailed by denunciations of the character and decency of people with different values and lifestyles. Differences of opinion are characterized as black and white, good versus evil. Good is said to belong only to those with similar political beliefs. There is something inherently misanthropic about this kind of politics, and it does not serve us well. It precludes the possibility of dialogue and civil debate. It admits no possibility of compromise. It respects no contrary beliefs or minority opinions. In short, it has no place for democracy. For if we don't believe in the basic goodness of our neighbors, then we certainly can't trust them to vote. While the politics of extremism make for good television, they make for bad government. Only moderation, tolerance, and openness ensure that. These values presume that people are basically good, so good, in fact, that they will return the umbrella when trusted to do so. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich Partners. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to hear Smart City broadcast, sign up for our podcast, listen to archive shows, and register for our weekly newsletter that recaps our discussion and provides all the links you need to our guest. Thanks to Charles Edwards at Georgia Public Radio for his production assistance. Jeffrey Reddick edits Smart City. Our theme music was created and performed by Robbie Grant and Steve Selvage. Smart City is a production of WKNO in Memphis. I'm Carol Coletta.